You're listening to CPC Together, a podcast produced by Central Peninsula Church in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Woo! All right.
Welcome back to the CPC Together podcast. We have been on hiatus for a few weeks.
We have.
And I've gotten so many angry emails.
Have you?
No. I hoped that I would, just because it would at least demonstrate the passion that people have for this.
You know, it's the holidays. We'll give it a pass.
There have been some people that are like, well, what, when are you going to release the next podcast? So that's kind of fun.
The suspense is over.
I am in the room here with Rachel and Sandy. Sandy preached the message on Sunday, in case you were not there. It was an excellent message. We're going to unpack it today. And Kevin, where's Kevin? Why is he not here?
He is working on his PhD thesis. He's in a cabin somewhere, holed up, trying to find those 50 pages he lost.
I imagine him with ratty clothes and like his beard all grown out long and like his hair's undone. Have you ever seen Kevin with his hair undone?
I think he usually hides it under a hat if it's not done.
I've never seen
But every
Kevin
now and then you'll get a glimpse.
Undone. Ever.
It would be fun to see. It'd be fun to see that. I'd like a picture of that. Okay, so Sandy, you opened up talking about road trips.
Yes.
And I'm curious, you guys, your best, or you can do your worst, whatever. Or just a crazy road trip story that you might have. My family did a lot of road trips when I was growing up, so.
Well, I've done a lot of youth ministry road trips, and those all have some kind of adventure. But the one I'm thinking about was the year of the Irvine earthquake. And we were taking a truckload of kids to Mexico.
Ooh.
I think we had 12, 15 passenger vans, two RVs. And five was still in pretty bad shape. The Grapevine was still in pretty bad shape. And every vehicle blew a tire on the way down to Mexico.
In the same spot?
At different spots, but mostly through the Grapevine. Because of the earthquake and the areas of that area that wasn't, like, they haven't fixed the roads yet.
So they were, like, running over cracks and stuff. Wow.
And then on the way back, we basically used all our spares. And on the way back, we had three vans lose, blow tires on the end of five. And so we we were just like rolling along to get off the off ramp at the end of five, where there's a gas station right there. And we
is it right before the Grapevine or after it?
Well, we were coming home, so
we were at Tejon Ranch or whatever that is.
Yeah, something like that. And we had to sit there for hours getting new tires for all these vehicles.
Oh gosh!
And it was a trip to remember.
The tire shop cleans up, you know they do, especially during stuff like that.
Oh yeah. I mean, it was one of those ones I remember forever. So,
Oh my gosh. What about you, Rach? Did you do many road trips growing up?
For us, like, a road trip was 2 hours. That's like, we did it twice as a family. We went to South Carolina with all of my dad's extended family. That was one time, and then another time just as our family. And that was a good, like, 13 hours from where we were in Pennsylvania at the time.
Wow.
And
now, did your dad ever, like, turn around in the car and say, if you girls don't stop fighting, I'm going to leave you on the side of the road?
He didn't. We played the quiet game. My dad was pretty strict, so no words were necessary to silence us. When we knew he needed quiet, he needed it quiet. But there was a lot of singing, and he endured it very well.
So, Rachel, I imagine you being, like, really, really good in the car. Like, you would never be like disobedient or rambunctious or anything, right?
So with the nickname Chili Beef,
right,
there's some spice. But I was the more like subtle one, to where I would like poke and prod my sister, to she would get like escalated and loud, And then she'd get in trouble for it.
So you wanted like a...
The typical
you tried
younger
to get a reaction.
Sibling.
Yeah. Yep. I thrived on that. But ultimately I got found out, so I had to change my strategy.
My brother and I were so much more rudimentary than that. We didn't have like deep strategies to sabotage each other. We would just like wrestle and fight, and my dad would do like the reach back thing. Be like, you guys!
Oh.
And we'd be like avoiding him, you know, like dodging his hand in the back. He always said he was going to pull over the car, but he never did.
I know. My dad used to say the same thing. And I always wonder if he would really pull a car over and leave us on the side of the road.
Did you ever test it?
There was one trip. There was one family ski trip that, I mean, I almost was, I thought for sure he might pull over. I can't remember what we were doing, but I was like 10, I think. And I remember going, oh, he might. I don't know. But I've always wondered, Dad, if you're listening, would you have left your children on the side of the road?
Well, of course, the answer now is no. You know, we'll never know how close he really was. My family, when I was 9, we moved to the Midwest, but all of my dad's side still lived in California. And so we lived in Iowa for a little while. We lived in Minnesota for a little while. And we just didn't have money to like fly back to visit. And so we would drive.
Wow.
And we had this old, I can still remember it. It's like one of those old, I feel like they're called conversion vans. The big boxy vans with the spare tire on the back. They have like captain's chairs, and you could set up like a little game table inside it. Mm-hmm. Some of the nicer ones had like a kitchen in them, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Ours did not have a kitchen or a game table. Ours had a chair, one of the captain's chairs, the swivel thing that makes it like turn. You could actually swivel it and turn backwards if you want. That was broken.
Oh, no.
So we'd fight over who gets that chair.
No way.
Because if you take a turn right, you know, the whole chair spins. Whoa. But we would do that trip. It was like, you know, from Iowa, it was like maybe 2,300 miles.
Oh, my gosh.
And we'd get in the car, and we would drive out to California. And oh, my gosh, man. It's you just go on Interstate 80, which is what you do from Iowa to California, almost the entire way. It's the worst part of every state. Like, you go through Nebraska. First of all, you finish out Iowa, which Iowa is just a lot of corn. And you're like, oh, finally, we're in a new state. And Nebraska somehow is even worse than Iowa. There's nothing.
Don't they have lots of corn, too?
They have lots of corn. Yeah, but I don't know why. Maybe because it's just so long and you go through the whole state. Yeah, and that was brutal. And then we went, but so we did that trip so many times, and we didn't have, you know, phones and stuff.
Right.
So that's when I really started loving, my dad would play these like Louis L'Amour, cowboy stories on like book on tape things.
Okay.
And that was just like the best ever, because otherwise it was just pure boredom.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of those trips, our car didn't have air conditioning and that kind of thing. But we would usually take like 3 days to go that far. But one trip when we were older, my brother and I convinced my mom and dad to let us do a trip with a friend of our family that needed to go out to California. And so we decided that we were going to try to make the trip 2,300 miles with no stopping, just gas, no sleeping, nothing. And we did it. We did it in like, I want to say we did it in like 30 hours.
Wow.
Or something
impressive.
Like that.
Wow.
We just all took turns, and his car was like on its last legs. And the one thing I remember is, if you guys haven't been on Interstate 80 in Salt Lake City, have you, either of you?
Mm-mm. Mm-mm.
You go through the salt flats where they do all like the land speed records and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Which is cool to look at for about 2 minutes. But there's all these mountains in the background, and they don't look that far. So my brother and I convinced my friend to let us run to the mountains and come back. And we start running, my brother and I, and the salt flats are bright white. It's the Utah desert, so it's like super hot.
Oh.
And we're running in this like blazing heat. We did not bring water. The sun is baking us from the sky and from the reflection of the white salt. And we're just dying. And we're like, these mountains aren't getting any closer. And finally, we decided to turn around. But at that point, we're like miles from the car. And we walked back and we got so sunburnt. And honestly, that's one of my best memories.
Well, there you go.
You definitely get creative.
The salt flats
fun.
Of Utah.
Yeah.
On road trips.
But you talk, you're so right, Sandy. Like on road trips, like you're either going to get personal or it's going to be awkward, especially on a road trip that's as long as going, you know, like Rachel, like going to South Carolina or whatever. You can either resist that or you can just embrace and be like, all right, let's do this. Let's have fun. And
yeah, make the most of it.
Yeah. But you know, you talked about how ministry is personal, which I think to a lot of people, they're kind of thinking like, duh, you know, of course it's ministry. We minister to each other, but there's a little bit different of a side to that, especially for us three working at a church. Sometimes there's a pull. There can be a pull away from that. What do you think? I mean, do you agree with that?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I worked for the church I talked about in my sermon. It was a much smaller church. You know, everyone kind of knew everybody. And then when I came to CPC, it was a much smaller church. Everyone kind of knew everybody. And then we had this explosion of growth. And then we turn into two campuses and then three campuses. And there comes an element that you're an event machine. And it's really hard. At least my struggle has always been, how do you keep the personal with what you have, this event you're trying to pull off that has 500 people at it. And you can't always have the time to sit there and chat with people because you're trying to do this big event. And I think the struggle for me always has with these big events have always been, how do I keep it personal? And I don't always do well at that.
And I think the pandemic plays an interesting piece in kind of reversing some of that. Because even when I was in like campus ministry in college, a lot of that was events, because the poll was like, how do we get more freshmen? How do we get more students to come to this thing that we want to do so that we can meet them? But it became a lot about like coming to the event and how to run it, what the timings were, who was leading it, that we didn't really spend much time focusing on like, okay, when we're there, like enjoy it and enjoy the people, get to know them, feel free to step away from whatever like your posting is and like get to know the people. So then even with like high school ministry, and then when the pandemic started, all we could do was FaceTime or like Zoom students. And that was actually really good, because it's the same students that we saw at some of the same events or camps. We could do less in a way, which made it harder, because so much of it is riding in the car, or I guess now it would just be like sitting on the bus or sitting in the cabin during winter retreat. But it was a lot of just face to face and just the person more than what can we do together, because that was limited. So in some ways, the pandemic helped me think back to, okay, it's about the personal ministry aspect more than the event.
That's a good point. Yeah. Our event, we couldn't have our event.
Yeah. No, even if you wanted to.
It's like, what does ministry look like now? We can't do our events. I remember my first ministry job, they gave us, they would rotate this, and Sandy, I'm sure you've encountered this before at ministries, maybe even here at one point, they give you a pager for when you're the on-call pastor.
Oh, yes, yes.
And so they have this whole schedule, and like the office assistant would make sure that the pastor gets his pager in the morning. And, you know, I was like brand new to ministry, had no clue, you know, hadn't really done a hospital visit or anything like that. And, but I had this big job to do at what I considered to be a big church, and I didn't really know what I was doing. So I was really focused on the details, like what you guys are talking about, you know, like getting, making sure, you know, I had like this small job in a big worship ministry. So I had to like make charts for the musicians and that kind of stuff, but they still put me on the pastoral list. And so, I remember getting those calls, and I was really nervous to deal with that, because I wasn't really prepared to deal with people. I thought when they were hiring me that I was getting hired to lead worship, you know, that was my thing. I was a musician and I'd go and lead worship. I'm like, why am I having to deal with people? And I would do that, and I would just be so like filled with anxiety, you know, going to these hospital visits, and am I going to say the right thing and all that kind of stuff. And it wasn't until later in ministry that my mindset started shifting and realizing, no, these things are the main events. the other things are, you know, are important. What we do is important, and you know, it's our job, and if we didn't do that, it would be, not be good, you know. But like, our main thing is the people.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so when we come back from a crazy busy season and someone needs a pastor for a funeral last minute, like, now I can say, instead of being inconvenienced by it or distracted right. by it, I can say, no, this is why I do what I do. It's yeah. getting in the trenches with people. It's going on those long road trips. It's being there for people's darkest hour. And honestly, I've made the shift that that's the biggest privilege of this job.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, is it being is. Able to walk through that with.
Well, we were just at the same memorial.
Yeah.
You know, and it's being able to show up and whatever capacity, minister to friends, family, students, and help care for their soul in a really hard time.
Yeah.
You know?
And what I love about that and what you said on Sunday is that it's something that's accessible for everyone.
Like, everybody.
You don't have to be in full-time ministry.
That's right.
To do personal ministry, which is encouraging and challenging at the same time.
Yeah, and I don't think that pull, the more I've thought about it, that pull towards handling the details instead of the people, I don't know that that is a pull that's unique to people in ministry. I feel like all of us, those people that are listening that maybe don't, you know, your vocation isn't isn't full-time ministry, but there's still this thing that it's a little easier to deal with the details of life than to sit in the mess of somebody else's life. And one of the things, as you kind of unpack this story with Jesus, is you realize, like you said, he was never really too busy for people.
Right. Mm.
Like, he understood, I mean, he had the capacity to be very busy if he wanted to be.
Right.
Yeah.
But he never had too much going on that he couldn't stop. And I just kind of wanted Sandy, you to recap a little bit this interaction. So I think it's so special, this interaction that Jesus had with this deaf and mute man, and understanding that, like, a person who can't hear and can't really talk in that society, what kind of life they would have had, and the compassion that Jesus had on them.
Well, just even, I unpacked it a little bit about being more of an observer of life than necessarily a participant of life in those days, in just how they were seen, the stigmas they faced, very similar to today in some ways, but obviously, you know, we've got American Sign Language, there's a way to communicate now, but in those days, not so much. And so for Jesus, I think to stop what he was doing when this group of friends brought him to Jesus, to stop what he was doing, to pull him aside from the crowd, and really just try to communicate in a way this man would understand. And, you know, I think this day and age, we have all kinds of ways we can communicate.
Yeah.
You know, we communicate through emojis, we communicate with our hands, we communicate with words. I mean, there's all kinds of ways we can communicate.
Says the communications pastor.
Says the communications pastor.
It's true, though.
You know, but Jesus knew exactly how to communicate with this man to help him understand.
Yeah.
And that's a tall order.
Mm. Hmm. And can you imagine what it would have been like for him being the observer, not ever having someone, you know, really try to communicate with you that way, and to finally be seen by somebody. And, you know, it's like, that must have been such, just that before he even got healed.
Yeah.
To have a guy come in and be like, hey, I see you. I'm here with you.
Yeah.
Like, I'm here for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Such a powerful power message. So you broke it down kind of into a few different things of this interaction that Jesus has. Walk us through.
You know, this group of friends brings him to Jesus. We don't know like how big the crowd was or anything like that, but for whatever reason, Jesus pulls him aside. He pulls him away from the crowd. And, you know, there's all kinds of speculations of why he did that. But he does pull him aside, and then he takes a time, as I kind of alluded to on Sunday, you know, puts his fingers in his ears, he spits and touches his tongue. It was really, in a lot of ways, a way to communicate, hey, I'm going to bring healing to those areas of your life. So you'll be able to hear, so you'll be able to talk, to speak plainly, I think is what Mark wrote. But also, I think there's this compassion that comes over him as he feels the weight of this man's life so far.
Yeah.
And he prays, he looks to the Father, basically signaling, hey, this healing is coming from God.
Yeah.
God is going to use me to heal you. And then, you know, he has this sigh, and literally translated, he groans. And I think that's where this compassion piece comes. Jesus is feeling the weight of this man's life and all the things he's gone through, and doesn't necessarily have the words to put it all together in prayer. And then he says, he turns to the crowd and says, don't tell anyone. And, you know, obviously Jesus has done this on many occasions. And the interesting thing is, I wasn't clear in my study of whether he was telling the crowds this, or if he was telling the crowds and the man.
Yeah. Or the friends and the man. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I do know he tells the crowd, don't tell anybody, you know, and you know, in the things that I read and the things that I studied, a lot of that just had to do with how would that impede Jesus's ministry in the short term?
Yeah.
It would benefit his ministry in the long term. But at this point in the story, you know, Jesus probably got a year and a half left of ministry. And so here we go. He's got to use his time that he has left. He's got to use it well. So hence the don't tell anyone.
I was thinking about that, and this is just my own thought. I don't know if this is accurate or not, but I was thinking that, you know, one of the reasons that he might say, don't tell anybody, you know, he's resisting, and you see him resisting fame.
Yeah.
And especially in our world where we have, you know, like, we have this, like, Pollyanna view of fame.
Yeah.
You know, like, fame is synonymous with rich, is synonymous with power, and if you can just do that, become an influencer or whatever. But I've talked a lot about this with, you guys remember Brian, and Brian is becoming famous before our eyes on TikTok.
He's, TikTok, you know, releasing, and Instagram.
And I remember us having this conversation, and I don't think he'd mind me saying this, but you know, he's asking me when it comes to my music career, like, do you want to be famous? And I was like, no, I do not want to be. He was like, what? I was like, do you? He's like, yeah, absolutely. I want to become famous. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to become famous and then use the power and, you know, things for good.
Yeah.
And he was like, why wouldn't you want to? And I just realized, like, the tiny bit of fame that you get from being on stage every week, like, you know, what, like a couple hundred people, 500 people, 1,000 people see you every week, and they know a piece of you. And then they're like, I know Brandon. And you can feel it. And this isn't wrong. I'm not saying this is wrong at all, but you can feel it when they come up to you. When someone comes up to you and you've met them before, but you don't really know them that well, but they feel like they know you really well. And it's this, it ends up leaving me anyway, feeling kind of lonely. Like fame, people know this little part of you, but they don't really know what's going on deep inside of you. You know, they don't know that it's not a super personal, fame is the opposite of personal. It's the complete opposite. And so I could see Jesus being resisting that fame, be like, no, I'm here, to your point, Sandy, to be personal. I'm here for individuals. I'm not here for, you know, notoriety and so that crowds can, you know, look at me for this one healing that I'm doing and say, oh, he's the guy that does magic tricks, you know? So I don't know. I was just thinking about that with the don't tell anybody. But I want to go back to the prayers and the groans. I'm curious if either of you have experienced anything like that where you have been ministering to someone or been with someone, you may have even alluded to it a little bit on Sunday, Sandy, where you kind of feel that kind of holy mm-hmm. compassion come over you for mm-hmm. for someone.
I have on several occasions, and I hate to say it, but it's almost kind of embarrassing when you're trying to pray for someone and you just don't have the words.
Yeah.
Because you're so overwhelmed by the circumstances and the compassion that you're having for this person. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you want to pray over this person.
Mm-hmm.
And it can feel, at least to me, a little embarrassing because I don't know what to say.
Yeah.
And oftentimes I just say it. I just say, I just don't even know what to say in this situation, Lord, but you know our hearts and you see us, you know us, and you know exactly what this person needs.
Why don't you try groaning?
Maybe I will next time.
I can just imagine that. Someone coming up and I'm just like, ah. That was for you. That was for you.
Maybe a sigh will suffice. That's a little better.
Sighs and silence.
Yeah. But I relate with that. It is kind of intimidating when the words don't come.
Yeah.
But in some ways, there's like a freedom to that, too. Because sometimes I think we're so quick to put words to what we're experiencing or to want to put words to what other people are experiencing. But our words might not even be what they are experiencing. But God, what you said, God does know. And even sometimes the lack of words, it's just allowing him to minister through silence or through presence of just being with that person and lifting it up to him together.
And I think the more you enter into the messiness of people's lives, the more it can feel like you don't have the words. Because you want to be compassionate. You want to be empathetic. You want to be pastoral, you know, and shepherd. But there are times where it's just so hard. And what the messiness that you're entering into, you may not have experience with that, or you're like, oh, I just want to say the right thing. That's the thing I'm always saying to myself. Oh, what am I going to say? You know, because you want to comfort people with your words. And sometimes you just can't because it's so hard and the groan is all you got.
It's so fascinating to me that Jesus here is modeling intercession. Like he's submitting this prayer to God. And later, you know, that's what we do. We submit our prayers to Jesus. And we say, Jesus, will you bring this to the Father? Will you do something about this? Because and it's a admission that the power is not in you or in your prayer. The power is in who you're praying to.
Yeah.
And it's just so cool that Jesus is doing that. I remember this one night when I was at a prayer house at like really late, and I was praying for a good friend of mine who's walked away from Jesus, and I was praying for him, and my heart just started just breaking. And I think someone was even playing that song. What's that old song? We don't do it anymore. Break my heart for what breaks yours.
Hosanna?
Yeah, Hosanna. Yeah. But that bridge, break my heart for what breaks yours.
Yeah.
And I just started just breaking open. I didn't have any words anymore, and I remember just submitting it and I don't know. So maybe it was just because it was really late, but I could I could feel Jesus submitting that prayer, you know, and it can feel like a passive thing when we pray for someone, but it's really not. We're submitting to the only one who has the authority to do anything. And it's just that Jesus modeled that, I think, is so, such a powerful thing.
It reminds me. I was just going to say, it reminds me of when he fed the 5,000, like even when he looked up to the Father in this scene with the deaf mute man, he did the same thing when he offered the bread
yeah.
before the people. And it was just kind of, even in the same way, like sighing and leaning on the Father in our prayer is a reminder of the same thing of like where
is power
that strength and
from?
Power comes from is ultimately from him. So in that sense, like we don't even have to really do anything. And it's crazy that Jesus models that because he can do anything, right. but he's reminded of where that power comes from.
Well,
and
I think
from the Father.
It was a reminder. We think of Jesus as being like the Son of God,
yeah.
but he was a man. He emptied himself of his divinity.
Hmm.
And I think that's an important piece to remember that he is, when he's looking up,
yeah.
that's the signal he's relying on his Father to work through him.
Yeah.
I wish I was better at that.
Me too.
Same. Yeah. Yeah.
I just feel like my first reaction is, okay, what can I do?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I want my first reaction to look up.
Yeah. Mm. Well, I think in our culture, you know, that's the thing we ask. What can I do for you? How can I help you? Mm. You see, you know, someone dies. Let me know what I can do for you. Do you need meals? That's the first thing I think most people gravitate to.
Hmm.
And not to make this sound bad, because I don't mean it that way, but it's probably one of the more easiest things that we can do. Instead of sitting in the pain or sitting in the hurt or sitting in the mess without all the answers, without all the words.
Yeah.
My grandpa and I just went on a little road trip down to see his childhood, well, his high school best friend.
Mm.
And they've kept in touch all these years, I don't know, for 70 years or something. They're both 89. They graduated the same year.
Wow.
They wrote songs together and he's in the hospital right now. Mm. And so we went down. Well, he called me because he doesn't want to drive that far. And he knows I know his friend. I write songs with his friend too. And so he said, can we go down? And he'd been admitted to the hospital. And I knew he was in the ICU. And I knew we wouldn't be able to see him. And so I'm kind of like, Grandpa, like, I get the impulse, but I don't want to be a burden on the family. And, you know, we're not going to be able to go in the hospital.
Yeah.
And we're not going to see him. And he's like, but I can see Myrna, his wife, you know, and I can see his son. And I was like, okay, I could tell, like, I wasn't getting it, but I could tell he wasn't going to back down.
Yeah.
So we got in the car, drove, you know, 3.5-4 hours and did this whole thing. And we got there and it ended up, his wife was too, she was just having too hard of a time. So she couldn't even come. And so we just hung out with his son and his son's, you know, his son's wife. And we were talking about it. My grandpa was just there. Hmm. You know, my grandpa is not a pastor by any means at all, but he understood that, like, what the family needed was for this long-term friend just to be there.
Yeah.
And my grandpa sat there and cried with them and hung out with them. And he didn't offer him any help or words of wisdom or, I mean, I think the sentiment was there. If they needed anything, we would have done it right away. But it was mostly just, hey, this is a crisis and here I am.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I thought it was so cool. And once again, you know, I was caught up in the tactile details of it, you know, why it's going to be a waste of time. It's going to be it's like, when am I going to learn, you know, that life is not about the most efficient thing, you know, sometimes. Sandy, so you kind of gave us four takeaways and four different things that maybe we could focus on, and probably some of us are stronger at some of these than others and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if you could just walk us through the four things again, just to kind of get that into our soul.
Well, we know the disciples were with Jesus. In this story, they seem a little on the sidelines watching. Okay, so you don't see a personal interaction with the disciples. But Jesus is on this 8-month journey with the disciples to teach them lessons about ministry. And we're seeing Jesus take the disciples into the Gentile territories. So that would have been a big thing for all these Jewish men to be serving in these Gentile territories. And so one of the things that that Jesus models is take people with you for ministry. And I think that is a wonderful example that, you know, one, we're never alone to do ministry. We always know God's with us, but take someone with you, teach them, you know, it's kind of that whole discipleship with Paul and Timothy and Barnabas and the, you know, all of that. But there is a piece of this that, you know, we learn ministry from one another. And I think that is just an awesome way to expand ministry. That is not all about you or me or whatnot.
What do you say to the person that says, I don't have anywhere to take people? I don't have anything to do. What am I going to show them?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know what? I think we all have things that we can teach people. I do. And, you know, like I work with a lot of next gen folks and I learn as much from them as they learn from me. And I think it's really about, are you willing to learn? You know, and it ties into the next thing, find new ways to minister. You know, Jesus takes this man aside and he ministers and communicates with him in a way that he can understand. And in our culture today, the things of the past just don't work anymore, you know?
Yeah, you mentioned the four spiritual laws.
Yes. Yeah, here I am, a former crew person from San Jose State. And I never quite understood why you would go up to a stranger and share the four spiritual laws. But I would, you know, and then I'm sitting next to, you know, I'm sitting next to Rachel, former crew staff person. And I go, I wonder if they even do the four spiritual laws anymore. Do they?
We did. We just called it something different, which now escapes my mind, but it's the same four laws.
There you go.
Same pamphlet.
There you go.
Different cover.
I think in our culture, we have to be able to learn how to talk about Jesus without using church words, without using Christianese. And one of the biggest lessons I learned, and I shared this in my sermon, that I had to learn how to communicate about who Jesus was and what he had done without using church words to a community that could care less about Jesus.
Well, you know, and
what was compelling for them to hear about Jesus?
Yeah.
How do I make that compelling for them?
Yeah.
Which is always your question. How do we make this compelling?
Yeah. I just get bored easy. So, but yeah, I mean, I think that's such a massive question, you know, and our culture today, you know, especially where we live right now, there can be even a hostility because they're lumping so many things in with, you know, there's these charged words now with Christianity. Evangelical is a charged word now. And so it may have been at one point in our culture, you're starting neutral with people.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're starting at a detriment.
Yeah.
And you can't, whether that's right or wrong or bad or good, you can't just ignore that.
Yeah.
You know, that when you have a conversation with someone, they have all these thoughts going on in their brain about what you believe and what you think and who you are. And so, yeah, to be able to adjust our style, not the message, we're not watering down the message, yeah. How do we get creative, or how do we get close enough to people to really convey that message in a way that they can understand?
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about this one story. I should have shared this on Sunday, but I didn't, but, I have an aunt and uncle that live down the road. And so we do breakfast every now and then. And my aunt's best friend, who is a self-confessed atheist, she always wants to come and have breakfast when I'm down. And I don't know why, but we've kind of struck up this relationship. And every time we have breakfast, Christianity comes up. And my uncle is not a big fan of Jesus either, or of Christianity, I should say. And even he sits there and, you know, she can't figure me out. It's like, well, aren't you an evangelical? Well, I'm a follower of Jesus. You know, what does that look like? I want to be like who Jesus was. And so trying to break down these like preconceived notions people have of that term Christian. And so, I mean, it's been a couple of years of just having breakfast and answering questions. And when I invited her to watch me give a sermon, she watched.
Wow.
And my aunt said, "Sandy, that would have never happened." And it was just like, you know, I don't know what God's doing.
Yeah.
But I just keep showing up and I keep trying to answer questions in a way that she can understand.
That's incredible. Yeah, I always think about, you know, cultural engagement in terms of like our social media platforms and how poorly we often Christians often engage culture. And there's this leadership guru that has this saying that I've always, it's just stuck with me. It says, do you want to make a point or do you want to make a difference?
Yeah.
And what you're saying here is, you know, to speak in a way that they understand, that's not you making a point.
Right.
That's you communicating in a way that makes a difference in their lives. Yeah. And I think sometimes we can get wrapped up in standing for our beliefs.
And our rights.
Yeah. And you know, it's not like I'm telling people to be coward, but like, check your heart in that. And are you trying to just make a point? And it doesn't matter if they hear it or not. Or are you really trying to make a difference in their lives?
Yeah.
Okay, so we got first two.
Yeah, and then we talked about prayer and that whole idea of feeling the weight, having compassion enough for the people who are in your life who maybe are lost, who are broken, who don't know Jesus, feeling the weight of what that is on your shoulders and bringing that to the Father, that whole piece of intercession. And then, you know, eventually we're going to have to speak the word, you know, and Jesus speaks the word, you know? And so to be prepared to speak the word in a way that individual is going to understand. And this stuff, I mean, obviously we see this small encounter with this man, right? But I really think just taking those four things, this is like building relationships with people.
Yeah.
This is, I mean, yes, sometimes this happens in a conversation like that. But in my experience, this is like years of walking with people and years of just showing up and being there and helping meet needs and eventually having the opportunity to speak the word, speak the truth.
I have a trouble sometimes with, if I know people aren't going to like what I'm going to say, I can feel that and it makes me not want to say it. I mean, that maybe sounds like kind of basic, but I'm very in tune with where people are at. And so I have a hard time sometimes speaking truth that might make people feel uncomfortable. Mm. And you know where this always shows up? On the golf course. On the golf course. And you guys, neither of you are golfers, right?
So
when
so
you
much.
Go, one of the things that they don't tell you when you're learning golf is when you go with less than four people, they pair you up with other people, random strangers. You meet for the first time on the tee and you like exchange names and then you spend an awkward 18 holes getting to know these randos. And sometimes they're cool and sometimes they're awkward and sometimes they're mean. Sometimes they don't want to talk to you. But every single round, there's a point in the round, it's usually hole 9, something like that, where they get comfortable and they say, "What do you do?" and every single time I get to that point, I'm like, okay, what can I say that I do that's not a lie, but that doesn't make them act weird?
Right.
Because if I say, "Oh, I'm a pastor," they're like, "Oh, cool." Yeah. They immediately stop swearing. You know, they like make sure they don't, you know, they just change their whole demeanor and they tighten up and it gets so weird. And so when I'm with people, the last time I went, I was with a guy that works at Microsoft and they're like, "What do you guys do?" I was like, "That guy works at Microsoft," and just hoping. And then eventually, you know, like they'll ask me and I'm like, "Oh, I'm a musician." And they're like, and I can tell what they're thinking. They're thinking, "You're a musician, who can afford to live in the Bay Area? That's not all you do. And so then they just assume like I'm a drug dealer or something. And eventually I have to tell them, actually, I work at a church. I'm a pastor. Oh. But I realize in me, like there's a, it's because I know that it's going to make things weird.
Yeah. Mm.
But over the years I have realized that when people find out you're a Christian or you're a pastor, a lot of times God uses that and people will, yeah. you know, and they'll ask you the craziest, like most direct yes. questions. You know, I was thinking, you know, why would God send blah, 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 yeah. blah. And you're like, oh, wow. You yeah. just asked me a spiritual question. Now we can spend nine holes talking about it. And so I, you know, that's kind of one of my things. Mm. I don't know which one of those that falls in. Maybe speak the word.
Yeah.
What about you guys? What's one that you guys feel like you need to step into more this year?
You know, I think for me, the one that I always, it's not that I always struggle with it, but it's the reminder that I can't do this on my own. It's the prayer piece. Yes. Mm. When I say I'm going to pray for you, yes, I will pray for you. But there is this piece of, you know, I can do this on my own.
Yeah.
I've been raised to be independent.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's of the four there. Those are the, that's the one that I always get a little struggle with because,
yeah.
you know, I want to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the one that is always like, oh yeah, maybe I should pray.
mm-hmm.
Yep. Or maybe I should pray more about this as I walk into this situation.
Yeah.
And so I don't always have that one on the forefront of my mind. I'm not looking to heaven and going, okay, Lord, here we go.
You know, if you hang around certain people, there are people that do that.
Yes.
Like, I feel like Rachel's mom, mm-hmm. Susie, she's one
my
of those.
My mom, same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's going to be like, we're going to have this, you know, we've had stressful mornings. She sings on worship yeah. dreams and stuff. And she'll be like, you know what? We need to pray for you right now. And I'm like, oh.
I've watched her do
oh,
that.
Okay.
Yes.
And it's such a gift because you did it and you're like, yeah, why didn't we start there?
Yeah.
Why did we wait so long to get to that moment?
You know, and I think it just in the culture we're raised in, we're taught to be independent.
Mm. Mm.
And so for me, that's the one that I always, oh, dang, I should have prayed first.
Yeah. Mm. How about you, Rach? We'll close with yours.
I think I would also say pray. And to me, that seems like the most like basic, like, duh, that's the one, like, that's where I thought like I would start. But so often I'm like the type of person that I'm like, okay, I want to find the right words. I want to help. I'm mm-hmm. like, how else can I help besides praying? You know, like that's a given. But then I do pray for that person, but not, I was talking about this morning with like, there's a difference between optimism and hope. Mm. And I pray for that person, but it's more to do the thing and then like to pray. Cross it off my list and then to want to help them. Mm. But then when I'm praying, am I actively like seeking wisdom from God on what he wants me to do? Am I actually entrusting it to him or am I still holding on control for myself?
Yeah.
And it's a nice thing to be like, yeah, I prayed for you or to say that. And I am genuinely wanting to walk alongside that person in prayer, but it's that level of just even groaning in prayer, like sighing and taking it to the Lord and being okay with not having the right words to pray in the moment, but just sitting in it.
Yeah.
And that's probably, even though it's the most basic, I'm like, yeah, of course, pray. I don't do it half as much as I'd want to.
Mm. Well, that's good. Sandy, again, amazing stuff. And I hope as you're listening to this, listener, that you're considering which one that you want to grow in as we start this new year. Our goal has not changed to become more like Jesus and to help other people become more like Jesus. I think we phrase it a little different than that, but
yeah, we say make him mature, more followers of Christ.
There you go. That's much more concise. So welcome back to the podcast. We will see you next week.
Have a great week.
Bye.